In this episode of the Guidewire podcast, we had an opportunity to speak with Dr. Alan Rosenbaum, the new clinician in residence for Fast Tracks. The goal was really to provide a sneak peek into what's going on in Fast Tracks and how we're developing our program. It's worth noting that the audio quality in this episode, just like the past few, is different. That's because we're still at home and we're still recording with our at-home equipment.
Welcome to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation. We are the boots on the ground inside of healthcare working to uncover and solve high-impact, unmet medical needs.
All right, welcome to the Guidewire podcast. I'm Devin Hubbard, your host, and I am joined today by two people that I am very excited to have today in the same, well, I guess, virtual room. We're not really together because of COVID, but two folks that are going to help, have helped, and are going to help continue laying the foundation for the way that we do things in Fast Tracks. I've got Gabe Lee, who's been working with us for, I don't know, almost over a year now, and Dr. Alan Rosenbaum, who is a clinician here at UNC. So if you guys want to just say a few words. So Gabe?
Yeah, thanks, Devin. So my name is Gabe. I'm an MD-MBA student over at Duke, slated to graduate actually up this upcoming year. So hopefully a future position. I've been working with Fast Tracks, like Devin said, for I think since last summer, so about a year and a half now, and been great being on board.
Yeah. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to be here. My name is Alan Rosenbaum. I'm an OBGYN in the Department of OBGYN at UNC, and I'm going to be working with Fast Tracks for the next 2 years as 10% FTE during my fellowship.
Great. Yeah, and we're excited to have you on board. So the prompt for this podcast was more to give folks a peek at what's going on behind the scenes with Fast Tracks, because, you know, one of the things that we'd like to do is share our techniques, but also kind of show folks, you know, how we've developed them. So this is going to be unusually open-ended and freeform, I think, today. So the reason that we brought Alan on board was really to help us round out our team, I guess you could say. So Gabe has been playing sort of several roles on our team, and we've been maybe abusing the fact that you also have some clinical training to our advantage. And I think what that highlighted was that we need providers to give a clinical perspective. I mean, we even had examples from in the last 2 weeks that you've been working with us, Alan. There's already been things that you've asked in our Slack channel that we're like, oh man, we didn't even think of that. So anyway, I thought it'd be cool to have a conversation about what the clinician in residence is and what it's maybe going to turn into and kind of the ideas that we're kicking around. And because Gabe was historically occupying a role similar to that and continues to do so, I think it would be a cool time for us to just talk about ideas that we have and what a clinician in residence looks like for somebody like Fast Tracks. And just as a primer for everybody, right? Like Fast Tracks, the goal of what we're doing is to innovate solutions to high impact unmet medical needs. And we do that by partnering with providers in the UNC healthcare network for the most part. So yeah, that's kind of the starting place for our conversation today. So first of all, I'm going to ask, do you guys have thoughts about that?
Yeah, definitely. Also, as a little primer for listeners out there, I've been, you know, slightly derelict in my work with Fast Tracks because I've been kind of back in my medical school rotations for my final year. And as a result, I actually have only met Alan very briefly once. So I think it'll be a really cool podcast for us to get to know each other better kind of on this recording and talk about what we envision for this role and what this role has historically been. But like Devin said, you know, I kind of got attached to this project really haphazardly, and it was a really awesome experience. I think I kind of came in from the ground level and saw kind of how Fast Tracks was being built, and to see where you guys are today is just like very, very awesome. And so I'm going to really enjoy talking to you guys, especially you, Alan, about kind of the role of the clinician with regards to medical device innovation in the academic setting.
Yeah, and just to sort of chime in on that topic as well, I think that, you know, clinicians obviously play an important role because they're the ones that are working with the devices and working with the patients on a day-to-day basis, and they're able to provide a different perspective. And, you know, one of the most important things of any biodesign team is to really get to know what the problem is, and you do that by empathizing with the people you're trying to help, whether it's the doctors or whether it's the patients, and having a different perspective from a clinician, I think, is key to that goal.
Yeah, I think that's something that Fast Tracks is acutely aware of and has been made more acutely aware of as we've gone through a couple different iterations of not only like problem ID, but just like understanding problems. You know, every problem from the healthcare setting is really complicated. I think having the perspective of a clinician is, well, you can't really do it. You really need a provider on board. And even if it's unrelated to to the field of interest. Like, for example, you know, we're having a discussion about a GI thing the other day, and I'm pretty sure, Alan, you were like, whoa, hold on. You know, think about it this way. And we're like, oh, yes. But yeah, I thought maybe we could talk about what the current role that we've sketched out for you looks like. And, you know, later on, I'm hopeful that we can all get in the booth together and actually talk about what happened and how things changed. So right now we have, Alan, I think you're 10%, right, with us. So we've got a certain number of hours of your time every week that we can basically just bombard you with questions. But that's not the only thing you're doing. So do you want to describe a little bit more about what we had talked about in terms of what role you were going to play?
Sure. I think that the overall larger goal for a project that I'm primarily going to take charge of over the next couple of years is to really assess and reflect upon what are the best ways that FastTrax can use clinicians and clinical providers as they try to solve problems within the clinical sphere. And I think that FastTrax has done a good job of identifying providers, either those who have reached out to FastTrax or those we have met through other interviews and projects just along the way. But finding a way to organize those providers and use them in a way that's respectful of their time, but still provides FastTrax valuable information as they try to solve some of these problems, potentially could help increase the effectiveness of FastTrax and hopefully can improve the relationship between FastTrax and clinicians in the future, something that lasts longer than my time here.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And that's kind of what we've been working through recently. So backing up a step, you know, before you came on board, we struggled to some degree with like what the best use of your time was. And largely because none of us are providers, with the exception of Gabe, who has some clinical training. None of us have any real clinical training. And so I think it's obvious that you guys can help out with informing and understanding problems. But there's more to that, right? There's more than just like, oh, here's a medical problem. You're the medicine person. Tell us about it. You know, like that's in a way that's kind of like boxing you in. And so I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts up front. I'm also going to just, while you're talking, I want to pull up the official list of things that we were going to do. And that's sort of like, before we brought you on board, we had this conversation internally about, you're like, what do we want to do? And the output of that was, why don't we ask Alan what he wants to do and how he can help us? And I'm going to pull up that document that you sent us just to use it as discussion points. But I'm kind of curious to hear what your thoughts are thus far.
Sure. So thus far, I think it's been a great opportunity. I know that things have sort of been slow and disjointed, and these are not normal times with the pandemic. So transitioning over to a new position in the middle of the summer, in the middle of the pandemic, was admittedly a challenge. But as things have gone over the last couple of weeks, I think the team members have gotten a little bit better sense of how I can be included on the already existing projects, being able to participate in meetings and interviews and discussions with other clinicians about the problems and issues that they're having and things that they would like our team to focus on to solve. Being able to participate in those interviews, I think, is really helpful from a different perspective, because sometimes it's a little bit more effective if you speak a little bit more of the lingo and you understand some of the basic ground knowledge and terminology in order to have that high-level conversation, potentially clinician to clinician. In terms of being able to help the team outside of those interviews, I think that I've been helpful in the last couple of weeks finding some journal articles and some background literature. What I do as part of my other research projects all the time is reviewing clinical research and clinical articles. In fact, my master's degree that I finished a couple of weeks ago was in clinical research and epidemiology. And so some of that stuff is definitely pertinent to identifying how big of a problem these things are and finding some articles that help support a case for or against some of the reports that we're hearing anecdotally from providers. And then I think in terms of the overall larger goal, in terms of just getting to work with the team and become integrated with the team and get to know the team, I think that over time, just building that rapport with the team members with FastTrax, I think is really important as we get to understand and learn the different steps of the processes that are necessary for NCTrax to find a problem, identify the one that's worth pursuing, and then develop a solution. Being able to just get my hands in every single pot and every single step along the way to potentially understand like where I can be most effective and most helpful to the engineering folks.
Yeah, I think there's another thing I'm thinking about here too. And Gabe, I'm curious to get your thoughts before we move on. But the other thought I have is like, presumably there's stuff you want to get out of this too, right? Like, I think that there's probably some value in training providers. And so, yeah, as you point out, right, like at some point, Alan, you're going to move along to the next thing. And we get the opportunity to work with you for the time being. It would be awesome for you to be able to leave here with something that you can then apply later on, whether that, you know, when we can talk about that. But Gabe, I'm curious to hear your thoughts as well too, on basically like what value a clinician brings to the table, and maybe more specifically, things that maybe we aren't thinking about, right? Like, what are things that uniquely position a provider that a non-provider wouldn't even be thinking about? Are there things that we're, that come to mind?
Yeah, I think actually one thing that really struck me, which you said kind of in the beginning, I think you really hit the nail on the head, is that you said, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, the best way to utilize Alan, you know, with him coming on board, you know, the first real doctor coming on board. And, you know, you said, well, it's not just about we need, you know, we got the medical guy now and let's get his medical opinion on things. And I think like that was something about this position that like really attracted me. So as a quick background, that my initial work with Fast Tracks was kind of like my, essentially my business school internship. So it was the summer after my first year of business school. And then I just kind of continued working with you guys. But the thing is, what you said is true. You know, it's not just the medical guy does the medical thing and the engineering guy does the, or gal does the engineering thing and the business gal or guy does the business thing. And I think that that's one of the pitfalls of many startups and many ideas of people doing entrepreneurship is that they silo special, compartmentalized specialization, and there's no crosstalk. And I think that Fast Tracks has done a really good job as it's getting started, making sure that you not only have the Andy who's doing business and the Devin who's doing engineering and the Alan who's doing medical stuff, but like really integrating it into one kind of holistic unit that works together, as opposed to thinking about each problem separately and then too late realizing that they don't work together.
That makes me think about stuff like if we had a crystal ball and could think of like, what are the pitfalls of our current approach, right? I'm now thinking like, what are things that we're in the spirit of trying to integrate and bring the team together? What are the things that are going to fail? And I guess we'll find out right later on, because I don't have clarity on that for sure. But Alan, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Gabe's getting at is really right on. I think that it's important for teams to be made up of individuals who are T-shaped. It's for the listeners who aren't familiar with the term, if you were to draw out on like a graph, a list of somebody's skills, if you have a bunch of people who are I-shaped, which means that they are really skilled at one specific area, they're experts in that area, but they're completely unskilled at everything else, then that bar graph kind of looks like a giant I. And that makes it difficult for them to communicate with each other. But in order to get a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of experience and to know the verbiage and the terminology of like many different spaces, you end up with a chart that looks like a T, or an upside down T rather. And when you have a bunch of individuals like that, that's really where the magic happens. I think that that allows a team to be able to communicate with each other effectively and build off of everybody's strengths.
And I also think adding to that, Alan, like, T-shape is obviously, if you have someone who's T-shaped, that's obviously great. But like, it's also important that everyone realizes that they have their limitations in other fields. And I think almost it's just equally as valuable to have many people who are I-shaped and then either a framework or a, you know, a culture in place that provides that horizontal line, you know, so that like fills in the T for everyone and encourages that kind of communication and crosstalk without necessarily, I mean, you don't need someone necessarily who both understands commercialization and the engineering and the medical side, because you're going to have people understand those things. But as long as they're kind of on the same page and you have a group that can work together and understand visualize the ultimate goal, whatever it is, I think that that's the important thing is something that, and that's something that Fast Tracks, I think, has the capability and is doing.
I have a couple thoughts on this one. So I agree. I'd like to think that Fast Tracks is probably more a bunch of T-shaped people just because of the nature of where we come from. That being said, you know, so Gabe, your point is really interesting and I think pertinent, because in a separate world, right, I teach medical device design, and one of the skills that our students tend to cultivate in their experience in our program is a communication set that is unique from many other engineering disciplines, which is the ability to communicate between engineers, providers, and then in some cases like regulatory agencies or business folks. And in large part because of their experience in design, it requires that, right? Like you can't do design really well without considering all angles. And those angles have to include, in the medical devices world, it's going to have to include a patient or provider or both, some in insurance. So there's money involved. You got to understand something about regulation is going to be involved. Like there's just all these different facets, legal components like intellectual property. Yeah, you don't have to be an expert in all of them, but you do have to know how to communicate, right? And that's something that maybe, you know, I think, A, you guys have both already helped us with that, right? Because we're learning terminology that we don't already know. We're also learning like just the general conduct, right? You know, maybe I have the luxury of being married to a provider, so I maybe have a little bit more insight into that than maybe the average person, but I don't know. I know words like what a fellow is, right? That's not necessarily common knowledge for people outside of the medical community, which sounds probably absurd to somebody who's in the medical community. Be like, what? You don't be like, what if I didn't know what the word graduate student means? Well, there probably are people that don't know that either, and that's fine. I think my point here is that there's always a communication barrier, and or what I should say is when you can lower a communication barrier, it makes a huge difference because then, yeah, your team operates more seamlessly. So that's certainly one of the big values. Let me back up a second. So Alan, I've pulled up the list of goals that we sort of discussed, and these are certainly not set in stone. But what I'm looking at and learning is that these sets of goals are both beneficial to us in Fast Tracks, as well as I think you, I'd like to think. And actually, it prompts a thought that I hadn't considered at the beginning, which is I think we should talk about what are the benefits for both parties. So I think it's pretty obvious on our end what we're getting out of it. I mean, just there's things that we didn't even anticipating being of value that you brought to the team, Alan, and same to you, Gabe, that until we had you on the team, we didn't realize. But on the other side of that coin, you know, here's the list, the short-term list, right? Do needs assessment for a non-OBGYN project. So you told us all at the beginning, you're an OBGYN. So Alan, I want to understand why that's on your list.
So beyond Fast Tracks, as I go throughout the rest of my career, I'd like to continue to work on biodesign teams, whether it's in the academic or the private or industrial spheres. And in order for me to be of value, I need to be able to expand and communicate and work on projects that might not necessarily be within the specific clinical realm in which I practice. In order to do that, I think that it would be really helpful, given that I have this great opportunity with Fast Tracks, and given that you guys have already started projects in other fields, obviously, than OBGYN, this gives me a great opportunity to jump on board and develop some of those skills that might make me more useful to teams in the future.
Okay. Gabe, I want to pick your brain. You've been through this. You've already participated in some activities that are unrelated to the area that you're thinking about going into. What would you say to that? You know, it's like, is there value in exploring things outside? Because I've got another question I want to ask both of you.
Definitely. I will also say, you know, I'm in a little bit of a different spot than Alan, where yes, like as I am planning on going into interventional radiology for my career, but I am a medical student and I have been a medical student since I've been working with you. So I'm a little bit more of a blank slate in that, A, you know, I joke about how I don't know anything, and that's semi-true, but I objectively don't know nearly as much about practicing clinical medicine as Alan, and I'm also not nearly as specialized. And so in that sense, I don't think that I can quite give the same perspective that he can on, you know, being in a different specialty, because the truth is I don't really have a specialty, though I will say, you know, coming in, knowing I was interested in IR and kind of pushing for Fast Tracks to work more with the IR department at UNC, which I'm glad, you know, has bared some fruit, but also being involved in other projects that I didn't necessarily see myself in has been extremely rewarding and valuable. So when I first came on, we were working with the pediatric orthopedic department on a halo gravity traction project. And actually, Dr. Lauer and I just submitted a paper on that to a journal. And, you know, that being involved with that project was very, very worthwhile for me. And I don't have any interest in going into pediatric orthopedics, spinal surgery, but the project was great. And I got to learn so much about other sides, like Alan is saying. So the paper we published was kind of more about for interested spinal centers, like if they want to implement this technology into their practice, like this is how we did it and this is how you can do it. And so learning about kind of the processes and how the device is actually implemented in terms of workflow through and how the workflow goes was a really useful experience for me.
Great. Now that's helpful. I mean, I was trying to understand from your perspective what your thoughts were too. So that's helpful. So here's the big question that I have for both of you guys and for Fast Tracks at large. And for anybody that's listening, if we can answer this question, I think it might be helpful. I have an answer in mind, but let me ask the question. Do you think that if you're working on a team like Fast Tracks, where we're working on medical device innovation at an academic center, and we're a dedicated entity to do so, do you think we need the right kind of provider on the team? Or can I just invite any provider off the street? What do you think?
So I think, like, I'm going to just assume that when you say right, that definition of the word right is up to my interpretation. But I think, first of all, it's definitely specialty agnostic. So I don't think that you need someone who's in a specialty that's very device centric. You know, you can have a hospitalist who could be just as valuable, if not more valuable, as some type of interventionalist who works with devices all the time. So I think getting the right provider is very important, but what right means is, I think, probably what you meant with the question about the subject for debate. And to me, that's someone who can provide the clinical acumen, but then, like I said, kind of integrate that in with the engineers and the business people and help to lead a team that is forward thinking in all of those areas. So it's not just someone who comes in there with their clinical, you know, perspective and leaves it at the clinical perspective, but it's someone who can help with that multidisciplinary team. And I think that that's kind of, especially in academics, where medicine is moving these days. It's no longer, you know, one physician telling a bunch of people what to do and leading a team. Having patients, it's them leading a team with people who are all equally contributing to the care of a patient. And I think that you can use that same analogy in medical device. So I don't think that you need someone who's from a specific specialty, but I do think you need the right person.
I'll chime in that I think that, like all areas of work, people and their personalities and their experiences fall somewhat on a bell curve. And there's different values to people on that different phases of the bell curve. You know, if you have a team solely of early adopting, innovative clinicians that are always excited about your projects, always willing to try an investigative device, I think that that's helpful. And there's definitely a role for those doctors. But every now and again, you need a late adopter, somebody who's a little more pessimistic, somebody who's willing to throw a little bit of sand in the gears and tell you, you know, to temper your expectations and maybe tell you all the problems that they think with your device and the things that they don't like about it. I mean, those folks play a role too, and getting a sense of someone who's maybe in the middle, who would follow the data and follow the early adopters if they think that something looks promising and exciting. And so I think that really it's a part of it's a numbers game and cultivating a group of providers who are willing to collaborate with you guys and provide feedback. I think there's value in more voices rather than few.
I tend to agree with both of you on this one too. So yeah, it was a leading question for sure. But interesting point, Alan. I think something that I find often on teams is they're always looking, there's confirmation bias, right? So, you know, if I'm working on the latest, greatest idea, most folks have a hard time just trying to seek out the weakest link, right? And testing that. And I thought your point about having a provider or set of providers who are willing to, quote, throw sand in the gears is kind of helpful. I think that's an interesting point. And what I'm taking from this, from both of your points, is, in at least if I were to summarize opinions, and correct me if I'm wrong, and here's my thought, is I'm hearing that it's good to have a variety of providers. And perhaps instead of worrying about if you've got the right kind of provider, there might be a right set of providers at a given time, right? So for example, if you're early on, you probably don't need somebody throwing sand in the gears, right? To like stifle your momentum, but you don't want to get so far down the process that, you know, you haven't checked yourself and made sure that, hey, actually, is this a good idea? Like, are people going to use this, right? Like, those are questions that need to get answered. And often the people who are going to answer those are the ones who are going to not be the early adopters, right? Early adopters are not good examples of the status quo when it comes to like implementing a new solution. So I think it's an interesting point. And so for folks that are listening, there we go. That was the question. I guess we'll see how that pans out, right? I mean, I think we're going to lean on you guys to help us find folks that are on that bell curve that you described, Alan. So let me fast forward a little bit on through some of the other, unless you guys have anything else to add.
One more interesting thing is, right, the idea of the clinician in residence and just kind of more to the idea that it's so specialty agnostic is medicine these days is already become such a segmented practice, right? And when you have someone in the hospital who's very sick, they're not going to have a doctor who's taking care of them. They're going to have, you know, a hospitalist or an internal medicine doctor taking care of them, but then they're going to have the infectious disease doctor for their infection. They're going to have the nephrologist looking at their kidneys. They're going to have the surgeon who's following them after, you know, postoperatively. And there's so many specialists involved, and that's kind of the nature of our medical system in today's world with, you know, advances in medical technology and an understanding of how pathology works. And I think that the same thing can be said here, right? Is not that you need the person who's in internal medicine specifically, but when you want the clinician in residence, you want the person who can provide some clinical acumen and background and understanding for those from the team who don't have it, but then also work with everyone, much like the primary person does in the hospital, working with all the different specialists with all these different projects when the team inevitably starts working in devices or biodesign ideas and in different fields of medicine.
Yeah, I have a lot of ideas about this that are making me think like bigger picture too, but I'll reserve those. But I almost have another idea for a totally separate podcast now on that sort of subject. But yeah, that's a good point. I think we'll find out as we go through this a little bit more about how the specialty agnosticism pans out, right? I guess what I can't, like my hypothesis is that really it is specialty agnostic, but I guess we won't know that until we test it, right? For example, I suspect that when we get to problems that are OBG related, we're probably going to get a lot faster and sharper and clearer answers than we would if it were something that had nothing to do with your specialty or training, Alan. And likewise for things like, you know, related to IR or just interventional stuff in general. So yeah, I guess we'll find out. I mean, it's an interesting point you make. I do agree that I don't think there's necessarily a specific specialty that you need to have, but if you're working on a project in ENT and you don't have somebody that you're consulting with from ENT, then I question what you're doing. But anyway, that's an interesting point, Gabe. I think for a clinician in residence, though, you're right.
What I will chime in and say, though, is that it's kind of funny for folks who work in academic hospitals, folks who like work with a lot of medical students, they're usually pretty good at telling who's going to go into what specialty based upon their personality. And so you might find differences in personalities, but they're of course innovators in all fields of medicine. And of course that sort of ability to work with the team and that sort of flexibility is what's most important. I can also say that, you know, when it does come to OBGYN projects, you're probably not only going to get like faster responses from me and things that I'm able to respond to more quickly without having to look up anything or check something that's published in the literature first. You'll probably also get my opinions on the matter, which in some instances may be really good and in some instances may not be so good. And so you'll have to have that filtered through as well.
Yeah, I'll be sure to be like opinion, not listening. No, I'm just kidding. That's an interesting point about medicine in general, though, right? Like if you ask four different providers from the same specialty how they would care for a patient, you're going to have four answers, right? Four different answers probably. And I mean, that probably begs a different question that maybe we should think about for fast tracks is like, how do we handle that? You know, especially if we're working on a technology that is, there's two points there. One, right? Adoption is going to be part of it. And two, not everyone manages patients the same way. And therefore, it's important to understand that when you're working on an unmet need, there may be multiple different versions of that need that are very specific to just the way that a person manages their patient or patient population. Anyway, just a thought.
It might mean that in terms of problems that fast tracks might work on, maybe there's a little bit better of a benefit working on something that's a little bit more blue skies. That way the rest of the field is clear and you guys as the first device or the first group into that arena might have that first mover's advantage so that you don't have as much variation in clinicians to be able to choose between other devices or other solutions perhaps. I don't know. You might be able to tell me in your ears as Devin if you disagree.
No, I don't disagree, but it prompts a question that is particularly relevant. So Alan, in your field, you're probably very well aware of the robotic surgeries. Would you agree with the following statement that OBs that use minimally invasive and robotic surgeries are likely to manage their patients the same way? And when it comes to like those procedures, was it the case that the first players in the robotic surgery realm like actually are driving things more? I don't know. I'm asking, I guess.
Are you asking like straight stick laparoscopy versus robotic surgery and the difference in the care provided to those patients based upon the providers?
I think that point that you just raised is actually more like that perhaps the variation in care has more to do with the procedure, right? Like if you're doing I don't know, let's take hysterectomy as an example. There's more than one way to do that, right? And you could use the Da Vinci, or you could do it laparoscopically, or you could do it open.
Or you can put a Mirena in everybody, and that prevents a lot of the hysterectomies from ever having to happen. That's the blue sky solution, I guess.
That's fair. I don't know. It's something that's interesting to think about because, you know, one of the theories of, at least if you look in traditional sort of biodesign textbook, biodesign specific advice, if you will, on that subject of like how to pick, you know, where on the spectrum from like incremental to blue skies do you try and pick a problem? Their advice is to try and be in that middle zone where you're like in between blue sky, but you're not in the incremental zone just because of the opportunity it affords and sort of the differentiation of market size, those sorts of things. But that's just, you know, that's almost subject to interpretation for sure.
And then also, how do you change that framework to adjust it to the academic setting where you're not in the traditional ballpark of medical device innovation? And a lot of the patients that people see on a regular basis are not patients that most people in the community setting would see on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I think because we're in an academic center, the acuity of our patients is probably more severe than because that's how medicine works now. Like if you think this through, like if academic medicine and medicine progresses the way that it's designed to, I guess you could say, then that should be what happens, right? Like then the crazier cases should be showing up because we're fixing the ones that can be managed, not at a hospital, right? And so that is an interesting thing to think about, right? For fast tracks or entities like fast tracks, do you get a biased and skewed opinion from bringing somebody who's in academic medicine into your realm? And should we be thinking about bringing clinicians in residence from not an academic center? I don't know. But then by contrast, we have the same question is like, if academic centers are where innovation is supposed to start and new techniques are going to get tested, the folks who are going to test drive most of these solutions are probably already here. I don't know. Alan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a case to be made either way. Certainly, you know, even going back to the robotic surgery example, I mean, there's a reason why a lot of rural hospitals have robots, even though like from a cost effectiveness perspective, it's probably unnecessary and not cost effective for the system at large. And part of it is that, you know, the surgeon isn't the only person who's participating in the surgery for these hysterectomies. And so you need to have a second set of hands that's skilled, and they have to be really skilled if you're going to have them participate in a laparoscopic straight stick surgery, whereas they can be less skilled if you're going to be doing a robotic surgery. But all of these procedures require extra bodies to be able to help you perform these surgeries. And if you're in a rural center or you're in a smaller community hospital, you may not have that sort of those sort of resources available to use. The robot helps you stretch a little bit the sort of patient that you might feel comfortable managing at your hospital as opposed to being forced to refer them to the larger big city academic place, you know, many miles down the road potentially. In terms of looking for what's most effective, I think that that's one of the challenges, right? I mean, you, Devin, I know have interest in global health and I do as well. And one of the problems that we have is that we might conceive or decide on solutions for some of these low resource locations without actually speaking with the folks there or really being on the ground or identifying the true needs that they have. And the same thing happens in the United States. If you are only working in an academic setting, you're probably not going to be developing solutions that are that helpful, at least in most instances, for low resource settings here in the United States. And so I think that while there's benefits of working in academia and being able to really truly push the boundaries of what is technologically possible, sometimes those solutions just don't compute for low resource settings, whether it's domestically or internationally.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. All right, we're getting close to time here, so I want to prompt one final question really quickly from both of you. If you were to put on your predictive hats to the best of your abilities at this point, what do you feel are your biggest concerns or the biggest potential pitfalls with a clinician in residence in an entity like Fast Tracks? And I can start. My concern is that one of two things, either one, we would pigeonhole you and say like, here's what you do, right? And we're only going to ask you OBGYN questions or whatever, or we're only going to think of you like a clinician. Alternatively, we'll do the opposite and just like dump all of our questions on you without considering maybe how we could leverage you better, right? And vice versa, right? Like we want to make sure that you're getting something out of it too. My third fear is that you're signing up for something and the only thing you're receiving is like salary and a bunch of questions. So those are my thoughts. curious to hear your thoughts. And, you know, at the next time we get together, we can chat about what happens or if any of these things actually come true. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Sure. Well, the way you phrased the question, it almost sounded like the ideal solution is giving me salary, but no questions.
No, I guess what I meant by that was that we were going to dump a bunch of, we were just going to use you as a pure consultation service.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's in part what I'm planning to do. And the challenge is, of course, expanding beyond that, right? And so I think that that is the overall goal of my primary project with Fast Tracks, is to really reflect on my experiences and your guys' experiences with clinicians in the past, and to try to build a little bit more of a framework to be able to expand beyond this consultative service, right? If you wanted a consultant, you can just like pay, you know, a couple hundred bucks an hour to some key opinion leader somewhere in the country, right? I mean, all the, you know, a lot of, you know, biomedical and biotech companies do that regularly, right? And you get that, you get their opinion for a specific issue and, you know, call it a day. But really, you're looking for, and I'm looking for, like a team member, somebody who's going to help enhance the work you guys are doing beyond like the sum of its parts. And being able to do that, and then being able to set up a system so that you can hopefully replicate that moving forward, I think is really the true goal.
I agree. Yeah, and I think one of the thoughts I have for maybe the next podcast that we record would be to talk about like the deficiencies or the gaps that we can fill with this type of role more specifically. Gabe, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think using the clinician in residence as a consultant is in essence what you should be doing with clinician residence, but, you know, making sure that you're asking the right questions. And again, I think it goes back to not siloing those questions off into purely medical, you know, I mean, have that clinician in residence, Alan, you know, like talk about questions about engineering that pertain to, you know, the practice of it, or supply chain things, procurement, you know, cost, how easy, operability, all of these things that I think that get overlooked when you get really excited that you have finally a real doctor and not a medical student on board, and you want to ask all these questions about just medicine. So I think the idea of using the clinician resident as a consultant is great, but making sure that you're using the consultant to the best of, you know, the team's degree.
Yeah. I think we'll leave it there. I mean, I guess I should ask, are there any final thoughts? You guys have any other thoughts you want to add that we didn't get to chat about today?
I look forward to having further interviews with you, Devin, over the upcoming years. And hopefully we'll see how successful things are. If not, we'll get to commiserate in the massive failures. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, either way, we're going to record a podcast about it. So, well, thanks guys for joining me today. That was really helpful. I think for the folks listening, just like this is a total work in progress and we're just presenting it how it is. So today's like, we literally had no script for today. We were just like chatting. So we'll see how things progress. But I think the next time, you know, by then we should have a better, clearer vision of for what clinician residence is going to do and the things maybe that we didn't think of that they're able to bring to the table, you know, perspectives or ideas or approaches. Those are all things that I think we need to talk about. So Gabe, Alan, thanks for joining me today. And we'll chat with you guys next time.
Yeah, thanks, Devin.
Thank you.
See ya. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Guidewire podcast. We thought it would be interesting to try something different and give you a sneak peek at what we're actively doing. We'll follow up with everybody so that you find out what happens and how things change. In the meantime, if you haven't done so already, you should consider subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite streaming service. Also, check us out at guidewire.unc.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at GuidewirePod. We hope you're all staying safe. We'll talk to you next time.
Learn more about our exciting activities, opportunities, and team by subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite listening service. If you have identified an unmet medical need or are interested in learning more about our process, visit us at guidewire.unc.edu. You have been listening to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation.